This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we're nearing the end of September, the traditional timing of Oktoberfest. Now, the big official event in Munich was canceled during the coronavirus pandemic, but we could still take the celebrating into our own hands with some beer, brats, and the focus of this week's edition of Food Friday, mustard. Oh, there's your traditional hot dog or bratwurst, but our next guest has a lot of thoughts on how to bring mustard into our daily lives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a mustard fan? Do you have a favorite flavor? Or do you keep the mustard far, far away? Call 800-642-1234. Barry Levinson is founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in Middleton. He has a new book out this summer. It's called The Art of Mustard. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be on.
Good to have you back. You've collected literally, I think, thousands of mustards over the year. Are you still discovering new ones that you've never encountered before?
Yeah, we do. It's hard to imagine. We have over 6,000 different mustards in the museum itself, as well as hundreds of other great pieces of mustard memorabilia, old mustard pots, mustard tins, mustard medicine containers, all kinds of things. And that's what the book, The Art of Mustard, is all about, where you can see it's not a cookbook. It's not not a recipe book, but it shows how mustard is an inspiration for great art over the years. So, you know, people can stop in. The museum is open. Of course, we do practice social distancing, and masks, of course, are required. But the museum in Middleton is open, and you can find more information on the website mustardmuseum.com. But yeah, let's talk about mustard. And by the way, mustard lovers are known for supporting public radio. You know that?
I did not know that. Let's see. I've already learned something, Barry.
Yes. Yeah, they do. They do. So all you mustard lovers out there, come on, support public radio. If you haven't done it before, this is a good time to do it.
Thank you so much, Barry. Well, you've told this story a couple times, but I think people might not have heard it. Share your mustard epiphany, your mustard moment that turned you on this new path.
Yeah, it was October 28, 1986. I was here in Wisconsin working at the Justice Department, but I'm originally from New England, which means, of course, I'm a Red Sox fan. And that was the year the Red Sox came so close to winning the World Series, but blew it. The famous error by Bill Buckner, game six.
Yeah.
They lost game seven. I was so depressed, despondent. I went to an all-night grocery store, an all-night supermarket. It was like 2:30 in the morning, and I was crying, pushing an empty cart down the aisles. I decided I needed a hobby. And when I was in front of the mustards, I heard this voice that said, "If you collect us, they will come." And that did it. That did it. I started collecting mustards that night. And 5 years later, I left the Attorney General's office and opened the Mustard Museum, formerly Mount Horeb. It's now in Middleton. We've been here a little almost 11 years. So it's been quite the ride. The museum, by the way, is a nonprofit like most museums. But you can come in and certainly you'll find lots of great mustards to buy in the gift shop. But really, it's an adventure just to be at the Mustard Museum and explore all the things that we've collected over the years.
Now, Barry, I think a lot of people are on board with mustard as a condiment. You put it on your brat, of course, hot dog, burger, sandwich, what have you. You are also into it. A lot of people are into using mustard in cooking. Can you give us a little inspiration to try to integrate mustard flavor, not just, you know, spreading it between two pieces of bread?
Yeah, I think the best way of using mustard is to make what I call an elegant mustard cream sauce. And it sounds complicated, but it is really French fast food. It's the easiest thing to do. Saute up some steaks or some chicken or anything, and then deglaze the pan. You know, throw in perhaps a little white wine or a little red wine if you'd like, just to get all the little things at the bottom, the fond at the bottom of the pan. Then add heavy cream, you know, as much as you want, and reduce it over very high heat until it's about half the original volume. Then when it's nice and thick, turn off the stove and whisk in some Dijon mustard. A couple tablespoons will do it, and you have an elegant mustard cream sauce that your guests will think took you hours to make, but it is so simple, and it is absolutely delicious. It is absolutely delicious.
You've got a recipe you shared with us. I'll do the French pronunciation. My boss will probably fire me. Poulet Madame Gaston Gérard. Tell us about this chicken recipe with mustard. Does that use that cream style sauce?
Yes, it does. But what it does, it's actually named for the wife of the mayor of the city of Dijon years ago. And it is the mustard cream sauce that adds Gruyere cheese as well over chicken. I actually had that in Dijon. It's a favorite dish. It's considered kind of an old-fashioned dish in the city of Dijon. But it was absolutely wonderful. So that's a great way of using it. And I'm glad you've got the recipe that you can share. Just use any non-sweet good Dijon mustard. It could be a grainy mustard. It could be an herb mustard. But you don't want to use a sweet mustard for that. So that's a great way of doing it. Another thing that you can do with mustard is use it as the basis for salad dressings. And I think you've also got a recipe. I think I shared it with you for a walnut salad dressing that uses walnut mustard from France, which was a grand champion at the Worldwide Mustard Competition. You can find it at the Mustard Museum. You might be able to find it elsewhere. Not likely. It comes from a very small mustard maker about 20 kilometers south of Dijon. And it's fabulous. You just take walnut oil, a nice vinegar, a mild vinegar. You mix it all together, and then you add, say, some toasted walnuts, some pears, and you get a fabulous dressing. Whenever we're invited out, you know, people say, could you bring that? Because my wife came up with the recipe, and we actually tasted that mustard on air with Oprah Winfrey. Oh, it was about 20 years ago. That was her favorite mustard. And as a result, we developed that recipe. So it's really a great thing to do because mustard is an emulsifier and it thickens up dressings beautifully. It keeps things together. So that's another way of using it, you know, as well as.
I'm going to jump in, Barry. We need to take a quick break here. We're talking to Barry Levinson, founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in Middleton. It's Food Friday. We're talking about the many varieties and uses of mustard. Find those recipes that Barry was talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite mustard, a favorite use for mustard? Are you a mustard fan, collector, mustard maker? Or do you have a question about what kind of mustard to use for what kind of dish? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Barry Levinson, founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum based in Middleton. Find a couple recipes that he shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. If you'd like to call in about mustard, do it quick. Not a lot of time left. If you have a favorite, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Barry, I know from you over the years, I know that there's an incredible variety of mustards. Back when I worked on the Joy Cardine show, I was kind of the designated taster when you would come in and bring mustards. Things from really sweet, as you mentioned, to one you gave me that I haven't forgiven you for because it's so darn spicy hot. Can you talk about the variety in the mustard world?
Well, the variety is showcased every year at the International Mustard Competition that's held here at the Mustard Museum, where we received mustards from all over the world. This year, we received mustards from Romania, from Japan, really from all over. And there are 17 different categories. So sure, there's yellow mustard, and that's a category. There's deli mustard. There's honey mustards. There are garlic mustards, herb mustards, fruit mustards, mustard-based barbecue sauces, hot pepper mustards, horseradish mustards. It really is an entire world of flavors. And that means you can do so many different things with mustard. You can add mustard to sour cream or yogurt to make a wonderful dip for veggies. So there's so many different things. Dill mustard, for example, is a great thing to have with salmon. In fact, one of my mother's favorite mustards her absolute favorite mustard was a dill garlic mustard that she loved to have with her salmon when she would go down when she was in the nursing home. And I had to bring her some, you know, a couple times a year because it really is an awesome, just a terrific combination of flavors, dill mustard and salmon. So there are a lot of things you can do. And mustard is also very healthy. You know, there are maybe 5 or 10 calories in a serving of mustard. You know, that's it's virtually nothing, low in calories, low in cholesterol, low in salt. So it's the it really is the perfect condiment. And for those of you that have little children or grandchildren that put that red stuff on their hot dogs and whatever, you should know that according to the National Condiment Research Council annual report that just came out last week, ketchup is now the leading cause of childhood stupidity in America.
Wow. I did not
so,
know that.
There you go.
Hey, here's a question you for you. Grant emailed to ask what your favorite dry mustard powder is.
Wow. You know, the classic one is, of course, Coleman's, which started in England in the early 1800s. And that's probably the most famous brand. And it is it's still an excellent dry mustard. And what you can do with dry mustard is, aside from making, say, a sweet hot mustard yourself, you can make Chinese mustard. You just stir some into cold water and maybe add a little sesame oil, and that's it. You make a paste out of it. And it will then, the day after, it will be much milder, but it will be fiery hot just 20 minutes after making it. So I would recommend that one. Or pretty much any mustard, dry mustard you're going to find. But Coleman's is the most famous one around the world.
We've got a couple callers having trouble getting with it. Okay, Nancy in Minocqua. We have time for a quick call. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. I had one question. If you could give us a good honey mustard, how to make a honey mustard. And I also wanted to tell you that I brought my grandchildren to the Mustard Museum down in Middleton, and it was absolutely fabulous.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Well, in terms of making your own honey mustard, I mean, there's a brand that we've developed called Slim and None Sweet and Nicely Hot Mustard that is really the best thing I've tasted. But you can just add honey to Dijon mustard and make it as sweet as you'd like. So that's it's a very simple thing to do. So that's an easy one. But glad your grandkids enjoyed their visit to the Mustard Museum. It's a good experience. And by the way, admission is free. We just charge you to leave.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Barry, this flew by. We'll have to have you back again soon. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Rob, it's always a pleasure. And hasta la mustard.
To you too. That's Barry Levinson, founder and curator of the National Mustard Museum in Middleton. Talk to him about mustard for this week's edition of Food Friday. Hey, check out a couple of the recipes that Barry shared with us. WPR.org/Food Friday, a great French Dijon chicken recipe and a walnut-related salad recipe. Both sound really good. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin recorded roughly 2,500 new COVID-19 cases today, making it the second highest daily count on record. The highest count recorded was just last Friday. The increase comes at a time when the United States has reached a grim milestone. As of yesterday, there have been nearly 203,000 deaths nationwide since the start of the pandemic. According to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, 1,265 people have died here in the state as a result of COVID-19. Our next guest joins us to break down this week's COVID statistics and what they can mean for hospitals statewide. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She's also a contributor to the Dear Pandemic website and social media pages. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back on the program.
Well, talk, please, about these numbers in Wisconsin. We have not been hit by this in terms of positive tests yet in this pandemic, right?
Yes, unfortunately, we are not in a good place going into the fall right now. We have a surge in cases in Wisconsin. As you mentioned, 2,500 new cases today. The 7-day average that was reported yesterday was nearly 2,000 cases a day. And we've seen a surge in cases among 18 to 24-year-olds over the past month or two.
Yeah, talk about that age group. When I look at the chart, everybody is going up, it looks like, but that age group in particular is really going up.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a steady increase across ages. I think, you know, with the reopening and with things being people interacting more over the summer months. But of course, we've had the resumption of college life, right? And so we are seeing a surge in cases among that age group, unfortunately.
But this isn't just a college student story. What are we seeing when we remove that 18 to 24 demographic from the picture?
Yeah, I mean, we are still seeing an increase in cases across the board. And unfortunately, we right now have the most people hospitalized, I think, that we've had since April. And so, you know, what we know is that there's a lag. There's a lag between when people become cases, when they transmit the infection to other people who may be more vulnerable or have suffer from complications, become hospitalized, and then we might be looking at a surge in deaths, you know, in the coming weeks. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that this is the place we're in the fall, and I think it just calls on people to sort of take a pause and rein in and think about where they can close up their social circles, you know, to emphasize using masks, to keep social distancing when you are interacting with others. As the temperatures are getting cooler and we're going to be inclined to move our activities indoors, it's going to become even more important to embrace those precautions to prevent transmission of infection.
And there's the thing. I think 6 months in, a lot of people are feeling kind of a fatigue, wanting to do stuff to get back to normal. I know in my own family, we've talked about, you know, can we do this thing that we wouldn't have done? It's a little higher risk. It seems like this is exactly, in Wisconsin, not the time to be making those changes, right?
Well, I think we have to, you know, we have to keep going with what we know works to break those chains of transmission, right? So if you, you know, can keep your social circle small and consistent, we can try to make, you know, stay outdoors as long as possible. So if that means getting some new winter gear or getting a space heater for your porch or whatever it is, I think we should try to keep those interactions outdoors, keep wearing masks, and do the things that we know work that can help us contain this, you know, infection in the community.
When people are weighing risks, I know people have a lot of very specific questions that they ask you on the Dear Pandemic website. But it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong with anything I say, all things considered, outdoor safer than indoor, less crowded, safer than more crowded, masked safer than unmasked, better ventilated, safer than unventilated. Those are some rules that we can pretty much take to the bank at this point. Is that right?
Yeah. So back in June, the group that I work with, Dear Pandemic, is a group of 10 PhD-trained female scientists. We have a social media-based science communication campaign. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are fielding questions from followers, anything pandemic-related. And we came up with a graphic, SMART, this acronym, space, mask, air, restrict, time. And, you know, it still holds up. These are the same guidelines and things that we are telling people they should apply, you know, now.
What are some of the most common questions you're getting lately at Dear Pandemic?
Well, a very hot topic right now is Halloween. You know, I think of the 10 of us, between all of us, we have 20 kids between ages 2 and 21. So, you know, we all are thinking, what are we going to do for this holiday as well? And I think, you know, most local health and the state health department are recommending we don't do traditional trick-or-treating, and we think about ways to modify that activity to be safe, right? So we are fielding questions about this and some of the, you know, things that we want to avoid with Halloween. If you imagine kids from different households gathering around a bowl of candy, reaching in, shouting, you know, trick or treat within short range of the people handing the candy out, that's sort of what we want to figure out how to modify, right? So some of the suggestions that we have gave to followers is if you could pre-prepare candy, like little treat bags, and put them out onto a table and be on your porch, then kids can walk by, grab a bag, and it doesn't involve close contact. I have seen really creative ideas about, you know, using a PVC pipe or some other way to create like a delivery tube, you know, to deliver candy at a distance to people who are trick-or-treating. You know, most Halloween costumes do have masks, but we still would recommend that you wear a cloth mask. So integrating that into your child's costume is a great solution. You know, in general, we want to, you know, avoid crowds, not hang out indoors, you know, having a costume party, and, you know, try to keep, if you do go out and you are trick-or-treating, to keep with the same people who you already have contact with is the best way, you know, avoiding crowds and sort of thinking, how can I enjoy this holiday, but, you know, not have as close a contact with individuals as we normally would.
Talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee's School of Public Health, talking about the latest pandemic news as numbers, case numbers, positive tests go up in Wisconsin. Amanda, there's been a lot of talk, including some from some political figures on this show, saying, hey, herd immunity is the answer here. If enough of us have a resistance, this will stop the disease. One way to get there is a vaccine, which we don't have yet. So where are we? How close would we be to getting, I guess, natural herd immunity because enough people have had this thing?
Well, we do not want to achieve herd immunity through natural infection. That would be catastrophic. You know, we would be looking at millions more deaths in the U.S. if we were to let that happen. And it wouldn't be, you know, something that would happen overnight either. You know, the estimates are that we would need to achieve around 60 to 70% of the population to be infected with COVID-19. We're still learning a lot, though, about how long immunity lasts. You know, it may be that we, if you have infection, you know, we, like other coronaviruses, immunity lasts around 1 to 2 years. So we're not looking at permanent immunity, probably, from natural infection. Whereas with a vaccine, we might be able to achieve longer term immunity. And so I think this idea that we should just let this infection sort of run its course through the population is a really dangerous idea. And it's not what public health professionals are recommending in any way.
And Amanda, I think there's a lot of focus, understandably, on the number of deaths because of coronavirus. What are we learning so far about the impact this can have on people longer term, even if they survive the disease?
Yeah, we are still learning, but there's a whole class of people who get COVID-19 that are called, are people are calling long haulers or long COVID. People who, you know, their symptoms don't seem to go away right away. They sort of experience the adverse effects of COVID-19 for months. There's also sort of damage to different organs and tissues of the body in people who get COVID-19 that we don't know the long-term prognosis. Of that damage. So we have a lot to learn, even though it feels like we've been in this pandemic for a century now, and it feels, you know, a long time to be dealing with it. In the grand scheme of things, we are still learning about this infection, and it'll take a while to really understand the long-term implications of this infection for those that don't, you know, unfortunately pass away, but still experience a lot of morbidity.
Let's take a minute or two to talk about our mental and emotional well-being, because this is a scary thing, a dangerous thing. It's cut us off from a lot of our regular lines of support. And I know depression rates are higher, and people are maybe drinking more or doing other things that are not, you know, the greatest coping mechanisms. What would you tell people about maintaining not just their physical health, but the other stuff, too?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really big issue, right? So staying home and being socially isolated isn't ideal for mental health. You know, I think staying in contact with people to the extent you can, you know, either virtually, if family are far away, or, you know, having a social network of people that is consistent and that you sort of, you know, can get outdoors with and, you know, socialize with is great. Getting outside to get physical activity is also really important, you know, while we can. And so I think if you are experiencing, you know, symptoms of depression or anxiety, or you're struggling with substance abuse, you know, that it can be challenging. And we would encourage people to reach out to resources, you know, in their community to help cope with, you know, some of the stressors that are entail having to sort of be socially isolated.
One last question, Amanda. I've seen some reports that people are skipping their childhood vaccinations or immunizations because they don't want to get exposed to COVID. And then there's the question of, are people going to go out and get their flu vaccines this year? What would you say to people weighing those options?
I would say getting the flu vaccine is probably one of the most important things that you can do right now in this stage of the pandemic. The symptoms of flu and COVID are highly overlapping. And so the less people we have that end up getting the flu and having to sort of go to the doctor and probably will need a COVID test just to rule COVID out, the better. And we also know that a fair number of people who get seasonal influenza virus do end up hospitalized. So, what we want to avoid is this, what's being called a potential twindemic of circulating influenza as well as COVID-19. And luckily, many of the precautions that we take around social distancing, hand washing, and mask use are going to have an effect on breaking the chains and transmission of influenza as well. But yes, and so in terms of getting childhood vaccines, please go contact your doctor. Doctor's offices are taking a lot of precautions. Wearing a mask at the doctor's office and going is a is a safe thing you can do, and they are taking the right steps to protect people from COVID-19 in that setting. And please do go get your childhood vaccinations.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. She joined us today to talk about the growing rates and the number of COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin. You can find more at the Dear Pandemic website, Facebook page, Instagram, many social media. You can check out her work and that of her colleagues at Dear Pandemic. Coming up, some world leaders have said they'll be planting 1 trillion trees in an effort to combat climate change. We'll talk with a forestry expert about the impact that could actually have.